the Dow Jones blasted to yet another record close this week, while the precious metals rally took a much-needed pause. Welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. I'm your host, Chris Waltzek. In this August 2nd broadcast, the show starts off with the Market Weatherman Report with the latest economic news and trends affecting your portfolio. Next, I open up the listener mailbag to tackle all of your questions and comments. Two gold bulls join me in a discussion on the precious metal sector and the economy. Harry S. Dent Jr. may be a professed deflationist, but he says that the gold market is oversold, that bears are too complacent, and gold is due a strong rally well into the 1500s. We also delve into the disappearing American entrepreneur and devise a cure for what ails the economy. Next, we hear from Jim Rogers from his home office in Singapore. Jim says the gold and silver markets are nearing a bottom, but not to expect an immediate snapback to new highs. This bottom could be complex in nature and may require some time, but those who do manage to stick with the long-term trend will be handsomely rewarded for their patience. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. Plus, if you haven't yet signed up for my Alpha Stocks newsletter, we have daily stock picks now, as well as penny stock picks for those with a stronger appetite for risk and return, as well as the model portfolios for the precious metals and the high dividend yielding stocks. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges after posting three consecutive winning weeks, the best month of the year, and the largest daily gain in over a year last week. The bull stampede paused on solid economic numbers and a dollar rebound. The Fed, the Bank of England, and the European Central Bank all held firm on rates and stimulus measures at their meeting triad this week. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold managed to regain the $1,300 support level, finishing the trading session at $1,312 an ounce. Silver bucked the downward trend, finishing near the break-even point, just shy of $20 at $1,992 an ounce. Unlike last Friday, where both metals were backward dated, gold remains in backwardation for the rest of this year. Demand for the metals remains red hot worldwide, with gold premiums at the Shanghai Exchange $18 above the London Exchange price. China appears to be compensating for much of the sluggish gold imports into India, where officials are attempting to stop gold from crossing its borders via high taxes to improve the nation's ailing balance of payments. China remains the world's second biggest buyer, with some analysts expecting the nation to soon earn the top title. In related news, July was the best month for the precious metals this year on the heels of comments from the Fed Chairman Ben S. Bernanke that it is too early to taper the $86 billion monthly bond buying QE program by this September. In fact, following the two-day FOMC meeting this week, the statement indicated that policymakers have pledged to continue with stimulus efforts, crushing the rumors that the Fed would lower monthly purchases from $85 billion to $65 billion later this fall. Fed officials discounted domestic economic growth, offering no clues as to the timing of any future stimulus tapering plans. Elsewhere, a worse-than-expected U.S. July jobs report from the Labor Department took some of the steam out of the U.S. dollar this week on Friday, which rallied this week, though, for the first time in a month. A bevy of positive economic reports caused some economists to expect a more robust jobs report. However, the figures showed that only 162,000 jobs were created, despite the impressive decline in the unemployment rate. National unemployment declined to a five-year low point from 7.6% to 7.4%, although the manufacturing sector saw improvement last month with the best showing in over 2 years. The disappointing payrolls growth encouraged gold and silver bulls who expect the Fed to maintain the highly inflationary QE efforts. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, clearly with little to no input from the Fed, the ECB, or the BOE this week, gold investors must now focus on the upcoming economic numbers. Still, the recent bottom does appear to be holding for the time being. If you'd like to find out more about next week's forecast and all the stock picks, you can log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility remained virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the sixth week running. Investors were emboldened by no more QE tapering comments from the FOMC meeting statement this week. Traders sent all three indices to new record highs. The Dow Jones Industrials added 15 points for the week, up fractionally, closing at a new bull market high of 15,658. The S&P added 18, finishing at 1,709, up over 1%, while the NASDAQ fared best, adding 76 points, up over 2%, ending at 3689. Wall Street is jubilant over solid manufacturing and employment numbers. The news was viewed as an indication that stimulus efforts will continue. Plus, the best unemployment rate in over 5 years suggests that consumer spending will improve, in turn increasing corporate profits and by proxy share prices. Turning to interesting stocks, well, last week's pick, Flagstar Bancorp, FBC, offers various financial products and services to consumers, businesses, and homeowners. Although the share price advance slowed somewhat this week, according to DCF analysis, it remains undervalued by about 50%. Plus, quarterly earnings are accelerating on an annual basis. The technical position is compelling. The stock only recently rebounded from the key 50-period moving average support level, which suggests an advance to a new high of $30 is likely. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the Fed, the ECB, and the Bank of England, they threw no curveballs, but actually they really threw no pitch at all. Well, essentially a balk. Given the continued improvement in the economy, there's just little reason to expect the market to roll over here. But things do also seem a bit extended as we look at the sentiment reading indicator here. We have reached the more greedy levels after recording very high fear levels several weeks earlier. So I think that the market is a bit extended here. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with economic wizard and investing legend Jim Rogers and Harry S. Dent Jr. So stay tuned for more financial edutainment headed your way. All right, it's that time to get caught up on a few listeners' questions and comments today, so opening up the mailbag. First at bat, it's Michael. He asks, what happens to mining stocks when the COMEX defaults? Well, hi, Michael. You know, if the COMEX enters default, as many folks have speculated, including Kyle Bass, not generally known in the gold crowd, at least, but he has made it very clear that on his trip to the COMEX, that there's only roughly 2 or 3% of the gold and silver necessary to meet all of those paper contracts outstanding. So he's speculated that a gold default is inevitable. Of course, there are other gold and silver exchanges, such as the London Exchange and now in China. However, the Shanghai Gold Exchange is much smaller, about one-tenth the size of the COMEX. Of course, that's going to change, I expect, very quickly. Nevertheless, the impact of a COMEX default could be quite profound. I would expect bullion and related equities to leap in price by as much as 20 to 50% overnight, following the announcement. That would be quite similar to what we saw occur to the gold shares on 9/11, the World Trade Center tragedy. Shares soared as short scrambled to cover, not knowing just how the news would impact demand for the yellow metal. You'd likely see eBay take over as a major precious metals distributor and exchange, as well as many of the large sellers, such as AppMex.com, gold retailers. We've, in fact, I think, seen many of these retailers already create their own secondary markets, such as Gold Eagle, which allows for instantaneous trading around the clock in a futures-like setting. So to directly answer your question, unlike the 1970s where the COMEX was the go-to exchange, with so many alternatives today, I think the market would quickly absorb the sea change event. However, anyone holding precious metals before the announcement, I think, would certainly see a substantial gain. Thanks very much, Michael. Moving on to Klaus, he says that I used to have some nice dividend-paying REITs in my Alpha Stocks newsletter. Some investors consider REITs as an inverse proxy for interest rates. If we are entering a cycle of rising interest rates for the next decade, would this lead to lower share prices for these vehicles. Keep up your great work. Love the show. Hi, Klaus. You know, I think you're correct. The REIT sector was a primary focus of many of my alpha stocks picks over the past year. The return has been, of course, very excellent when you factor in the extraordinarily high dividend yields on average over 10%. But my outlook on the sector is not quite as robust as it was. You'll want to listen to my discussion with Harry S. Dent Jr. later in the show on real estate. We are both concerned that the rebound could be temporary in housing, which could significantly impact the prospects of REITs going forward. In addition, at this week's FOMC meeting statement, well, officials made it clear that rates will be held low until unemployment falls back to the 6.5%. Currently, the domestic unemployment rate is around 7.6%, so I don't expect the Fed to allow rates to climb much higher. Now, you might ask yourself, how can they do that? They could twist rates by selling long-term bonds and buying short-term treasuries, which, of course, puts up the price and puts down the yield. Okay, thanks, Klaus. Next up at the batter's box, Eric from Blythewood, South Carolina, says he's followed my advice for many years in preparation for the forthcoming events, including inflation and what that will do to the economy. Well, his question is about the possibility of a replacement of the physical dollar with a digital currency. He fears the process would be very easy for the government to implement, and the results would be very favorable to the government. Large amounts of previously unreported income would be collected by the IRS, and the barter economy would wither on the vine. Hypothetically speaking, what are your thoughts on this situation? Well, hi, Eric. You know, I think this is a very interesting question. It's one that keeps me up at night sometimes. We are already reading reports of nations doing their best to discourage gold and silver ownership. For instance, in Europe, some countries are limiting the amount of precious metals purchased or sold. In Houston, fingerprinting and photos of gold selling is mandatory. However, I am sure you saw what happened with Bitcoin. There was a temporary shutdown on the market, and although Bitcoin still sells over $100, which is very impressive, many questions remain regarding their viability as a future currency alternative. Again, now, I am a huge fan of the Bitcoin market because I think it is a phenomenal breakthrough, but here's a scenario to ponder. Where else can we crystallize our wealth in a highly concentrated form, bury it in the backyard near, let's say, a metal pipe line to protect against metal detection? One single roll of gold coins can cost $100,000 or more. Would you feel that confident if you had $100,000 in, let's say, a digital currency, or in a safety deposit box, or in a brokerage somewhere? While the powers that be will continue to attempt to discourage the hoi polloi from owning precious metals, they still remain, I think, the very best place to protect your family's wealth. Okay, thanks for that interesting question, Eric. And next up, Chris says, why are the radio show archives unavailable? Hi, Chris. We were recently required to remove the archives to comply with the wishes of some pretty powerful interests. We hope at some point to solve the problem and make the shows freely available again to the public. Thanks, Chris. And next up, they'd like a yearly subscription to the Alpha Stocks newsletter, but do not have a PayPal account. And they ask if there is any other option, such as money order or credit card. Hi, yes, many Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers prefer to send in personal checks or money orders. You can request my address via email, and I'll just send it to you. The Alpha Stocks portfolio is doing very well. The 10% dividend yield, plus several percentage point profit already under its belt. In addition, we have a new daily stock picks, which continue to excel. The key is the stock screening and then filtering process, which reduces many hundreds of candidates down to just one or two per day. We monitor the market sentiment to help investors gauge when price is overbought and oversold given the current market trend. Now that the gold and silver equities are forming a bottom, we will be updating the precious metals equities model portfolio, which incidentally continues to outperform the XAU by about 10% annually. And don't forget the moonshot stock picks. Our penny stocks range from a few cents to a few dollars, many of which have returned 250% or more. So if you'd like to sign up, you can do so at the website, or as I said a moment ago, you can just send in a check if you'd like. We have very reasonable monthly, annual, 5-year and lifetime subscription rates. Next, Paul says he loves the show, but is unable to listen to the July 12th radio show with Bob Hoy. Hi, Paul. Yes, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we have all of our archives down for the moment, so just the last 3 or so shows are available, but we'll certainly announce it if and when they can be made available again. And next, Andrew is having the same issue. He tried to download a show from the June 28th interview with Lindsay Williams, but it wouldn't work. He wants to know if we can fix it. Well, as I mentioned, Andrew, we're going to do our best to have that back up as soon as possible. Thanks again. And lastly, Larry says he enjoys the show. He finds it very informative and entertaining. He's been listening for many years and wants us to keep up the great effort. As for the Houston fingerprinting of gold sellers in that area, he says it's only for the sale of jewelry, not coins and bars. He says it's to make it harder for thieves to sell their stolen gold jewelry. He wants me to make a correction so as not to frighten folks. Well, hi, Larry. Actually, according to the Houston Daily Examiner, the Houston City Council voted to require fingerprinting and photographs of anyone selling gold or silver of any kind. So until I can find evidence to the contrary, I think we may have to agree to disagree on this point. The idea, as you said, is to discourage home robberies and burglaries and to search for quick and easy gold and silver items. However, I am concerned about the unintended consequences, as I'm sure you are as well. For instance, do we really want the government to know anything about gold transactions? Why not encourage homeowners to own a gun and bolt locks on each door? At one of my alma maters, KSU, the town ordinance insisted that every homeowner must have a gun on the premises. It's the law. The town still has one of the lowest burglary and crime rates in the nation. So you can form your own opinions there. I'm not a huge firearms advocate, but it certainly seems highly correlated with a safer home. With that question, unfortunately, we've run brief on time. We're going to have to wrap up this week's show. But remember, we want to field your questions and comments, and you can call in if you'd like to. Toll free, 1-800-507-6531. Make sure that this is toll free in your area. It is in most of the U.S. and parts of Canada. But you want to make sure first. You can call in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Any question you might have, you can cancel, delete, and re-record if you like. 1-800-507-6531. Perhaps you'd prefer to remain anonymous. That's just fine. Or you might share your first name to give people an idea of who they're listening to. 1-800-507-6531. We hope you'll jot this down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your cell phone or telephone number. We'd like to field your questions and comments. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. So stay with us. So glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio for another Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Harry S. Dent Jr. Well, the FOMC released its latest meeting statement this week. Joining me to help decipher the Fed speak, Harry S. Dent Jr., head of an economic research and forecasting company and author of The Great Depression Ahead. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Oh, nice to be back, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion, if we could, with the latest FOMC meeting statement. The Fed noted that the unemployment rate remains stubbornly high, just echoing recent sentiments. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the national unemployment rate still around 7.6%. That's well above the Fed's 6.5% target following recent recessions. Unemployment typically would fall back in line with traditional measures. Not so this time. You know, Walmart is now our largest U.S. employer. From your perspective, why is the Fed having such a difficult time with unemployment?
Well, you know, it comes down to demographics, as we always say. Every time we've had a recession in the 80s or 90s, or baby boomers were always going to spend more money. They were in a positive spending cycle demographically, and the economy would come bouncing back. Well, it's not. I mean, the only reason the economy's growing at 2%, which has been the average since 2009 from the bottom, has been because of massive stimulus to help plug the holes and to help get people to spend just a little more. It's taken $2 trillion a year to get 2% growth or $300 billion in GDP. That's a horrible ratio and a horrible trade-off. So they're fighting demographic winds. They're fighting debt levels that were higher than any time in history compared to GDP in the business sectors and the financial sectors and the consumer sectors, government sectors. And, you know, that's a drain on the economy. So everybody's assuming, oh, the Fed just needs to stimulate till the economy gets back to normal. The economy's not going to get back to normal for another decade until the next generation comes along. And somewhere between now and then, I think sooner than later, we're going to have to deal with our debt and allow debt to deleverage like it did in the 1930s. You can't go forward. Japan's been trying to move forward with rising debt instead of falling, and they've just been in an economy for 23 years now, and it's taking even more massive stimulus there just to get them to grow a little bit. And so, you know, people don't realize the economy's not going to get back to normal. Demographic trends point down for the next decade, and debt levels are actually higher than they were when the crisis started in 2008 because government debt has gone up more than private debt's gone down. You can't keep adding debt to debt when one of the reasons you got in the first place was we had too much debt. And everybody's acting like the Fed can just, you know, get the economy to grow again. Well, they are getting it to grow a little, but with massive stimulus.
Look at the macro picture. Most of these economic models that our officials are following are generally cyclical in nature, and they tend to trough out and then peak out, and then you're back to business as usual. But I think what you're really suggesting here is a profound sea change event where things don't go back to normal, an economic reset where this debt must be finally dealt with. It can't just be shuffled off or pushed under the table. Ultimately, the day of reckoning is here.
Japan actually has been avoid dealing with it now for 23 years, but Japan went into its crisis when the rest of the world was booming. And we were about the only people to see that in the late 80s. We said Japan's going to have a 12 to 14-year demographic downturn, and the U.S. and Europe are going to see their best decade ever because the demographics of the baby boom in those countries are different. But in the case here, now it's the Fed, every other major government in the world, desperately stimulating all at the same time. Europe keeps weakening. China's bubble looks more and more like it's going to blow at some point. The Fed and other governments are stimulating at very high rates, and the economy at least creeps forward, with the exception of Europe, when you do that. The problem is if something goes wrong. And in 2008, that was the subprime crisis in the U.S. And you got to realize that was really occurred largely in just four or five states. Yet we had a worldwide crisis because all these banks are interlinked and everybody's stretched with debt already and demographics were starting to slow. So that's what I'm looking for. I mean, we've been bouncing now for over 4 years. Very few rallies last more than 3.5 to 5 years. I think something's going to go wrong. Europe gets worse. Somebody in the Eurozone has to exit or get kicked out. China's real estate bubbles finally starts to burst because they're having to rein in on it because they have a shadow banking system now that's growing faster than any in the world, and China's being forced to deal with it. Well, you deal with that, and then real estate prices go down. Real estate prices go down. Everybody in China owns real estate. And they save way more than we do, and they put most of their money in real estate, especially since the stock crash, you know, in 2008. And if real estate starts going down, Chinese consumers are going to feel it heavily. And if China slows down the whole world, that's the last thing holding the world up with the minor growth in the U.S. and actual recession more in Europe. So it's just going to take a trigger, and my guess is that's going to happen between late 2013 and early 2014. Markets are looking bubbly, but they're not looking like they're going to top yet. I mean, I think we're going to see Dow 16,000 here fairly soon, and I don't think that's going to be a top. But I do think you're going to start to see some sort of crash by early next year.
Yeah, Bill Fleckenstein is on board with you there. He's looking for a sudden drop to the downside, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'd like to return, though, to the recent Fed statement this week. Their mandate of maximum employment and low inflation, apparently they're going to continue with their QE policies in order to keep improving employment, continue purchasing additional mortgage-backed securities at a pace of $40 billion a month, plus their treasuries at $45 billion a month. That amounts to about $1 trillion a year. Now, you know, the Fed's balance sheet is currently $3.3 to $3.4 trillion. Do you see that trend continuing?
Well, you know, if we're allowed to. If we don't have a crisis that triggers a meltdown, that the Fed and central banks lose control of it, we just do the same thing Japan's been doing for many, many years. In a decade, we're going to have a $30 trillion government debt, and we're going to have a Fed balance sheet of $12 to $15 trillion. I mean, if this was a temporary crisis, then it could make sense to have QE to just kind of jumpstart the economy. But we've been doing QE nonstop now for 4.5 years. And by my calculations, looking at the demographic trends, and with us not dealing with debt, and debt's only going up, not down, you'd have to keep doing this for another 10 years. Well, we'll just roll out the numbers. I mean, $30 trillion is about where you're going to end up, and we'd have about the same debt-to-GDP ratio that Japan has, which is 250%. It'd be a little less than that for us. To think you can add debt to debt to cure a debt crisis, and to think that after 4 to 5 years, it's going to be a lot different. Governments have had to basically up the ante. China's upping the ante and pushing people off of farms and shoving them into high rises, even though they don't always have jobs. And, you know, Japan just tripled their stimulus out of desperation. And then, you know, the Fed upped the ante with QE3 and QE3 extended. And the truth is they're probably going to have to stimulate even more than this because the demographic trends only get worse. And the big thing for me, Chris, is the demographic trends in the next few years particularly get much worse in Europe, and Europe's already in trouble. So if Europe's in this much trouble and they haven't really fallen off what I call the demographic cliff yet, they've just kind of been on a plateau. If demographic trends start working more steadily against them, and guess which countries slow down first? Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and the UK, some of the strongest countries over there. So governments are going to have to stimulate as much or more for 10 years, and that's just not sustainable. At some point, bond markets and investors or somebody will pull the plug and say, okay, this isn't doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Well, we keep getting 2% growth in the U.S. no matter how much we stimulate. We keep getting negative growth, minor negative growth, instead of a depression. We get a minor recession in Europe despite all the bailouts and stimulus. And China keeps stimulating and making massive investments in their economy, you know, excess capacity. And their stock market keeps going down, and their GDP and exports keep slowing. So we're doing the same thing over and over again. And at some point, people are going to get, this ain't happening. This isn't working. And when people lose faith in it, then you're in trouble, just like when they lost faith in the southern European countries and interest rates started rising. If Mario Draghi hadn't stepped in and said, I'll basically blow you out of the water if you ever short a southern European bond, those countries would have been belly up. They would have had to gone bankrupt.
Housing sales recovered over the past year or so. We've seen pretty strong activity in that sector. Mortgage rates, though, are climbing, as noted in the latest FOMC meeting. They're watching that closely. Housing starts are, though, also sluggish. As a key component of the U.S. economy, what's your outlook on this sector?
Well, you know, housing is the most important sector. It was the last to turn around. People were the most in shock. They've never seen real estate go down in their lifetime in most places, because the last time was the 1930s. But now it's coming back. Interest rates got so low, and you know, you get backlog and demand. But the biggest thing that happened that most people don't realize is that, you know, the Fed keeps pumping all this money into Wall Street and the financial systems, and it has to be invested somewhere. Well, it's gone into stocks. Well, they bubbled up. It's gone into gold and commodities. Well, they bubbled up, and now they're falling. So a lot of hedge funds and investment funds say, well, we're going to start buying foreclosed houses and flipping them or renting them out. So a lot of this rebound in housing, they don't have the normal levels of buying from young couples who are really getting a mortgage and buying a house they're going to live in and have kids in. A lot of this is speculation, and there's signs that speculators are already retreating from this market because it's getting too pricey, it's getting too competitive. And if they drop out, I think housing, with rising mortgage rates and investors starting to sour on it, I think in the next few months you could see housing start to slow down, and if not then, by early next year. And I think that could be a pivot point because, yeah, jobs have been pretty good, but not if housing slows down again. So I think housing is the key sector, and I don't think the housing rebound lasts past this year. That's my forecast.
As rates go up, it simply just prices people out of the market. Folks start to say, well, maybe renting not such a bad option after all. I mean, who can afford these increases in monthly payments? And as you mentioned, you know, we've watched hedge funds and many other investment companies buying up the lion's share of these homes recently. And what happens is people just start renting them out. So renting is the new home ownership, at least that it seems to be the case. You know, we're seeing a huge drop across the nation here and many other frightening metrics. For instance, one recent survey showed that 4 out of 5 Americans are struggling with unemployment at some point in their career. And there simply hasn't been a time like this in national history, at least not if in many decades. Do you care to give folks an idea on whether or not this is going to become the new norm? Is this what we should expect? Or is this merely some turbulence on the way to prosperity?
It's not just a new norm. For the average household, it's been the norm even in the boom. Ever since about 2000, median household income, real, you know, adjusted for inflation, has been falling, and it continues to fall. The rich have been getting most of the gains. The upper 20%, who are 3.5% unemployment, college graduates, and they control over 50% of spending. You got the top 10%, even better than the top 1%. They're getting all the gains. A couple surveys now that reflect just what you said. 80% of people say we never came out of the Great Recession. 20% say, no, I'm doing better than ever. That's the difference. We got two economies. And the biggest difference is the top 20% spend a lot more money, so they control a little over 50%. So you got half of our economy doing great and half of it just struggling to get along. That struggling to get along is not going to change. It hasn't changed. It'll only get worse. The real question is, when do the rich see their kids leave the nest like the everyday person did in 2008 forward? And I think that's going to happen in the next year or two, because their kids just graduate later and they go to school later. So they peak in their spending later. But also, any turbulence in the markets, if real estate starts to collapse again, and especially stocks and financial assets, these top 20% hold almost all those financial assets, and they're going to feel it more. I think the affluent people are the next to go down, and when they go down, they're actually going to get hit worse relatively than the average household. But the average household's been struggling for you know, a decade and a half now.
I think one of the points of confusion here is clearly the way that we're looking at the numbers. For instance, everybody's looking at unemployment with regard to recessions and economic growth. But in the final analysis, economists firstly look at the GDP. Now, how is the GDP calculated? Well, using an inflation deflator. And if you aren't using accurate inflation numbers, your GDP number is completely off, because if you look at shadow stats, and we calculate our own GDP here, you're exactly right when you say things have been tough since the year 2000. There has been essentially no forward movement, forward progress in about 14 years as far as economic growth goes when you accurately calculate the price number or the inflation number. About 76% of Americans report that they are living from paycheck to paycheck. This is an unimaginable number, and we're talking in the neighborhood of, let's say, 240 million people, or the majority of households, are simply struggling to make ends meet. A big factor here is the unemployment situation, but the other component is prices, rising inflation. I'd like your thoughts on that, please.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the basic stuff, food and gasoline and stuff, you know, that people spend on day-to-day are going up. Yeah, housing's going down, but a lot of these people are already stuck in their house and can't get out of it if they want to, can't even refi because they don't qualify with a home underwater. So, yeah, they're not getting the benefits. The more affluent are getting the benefits of rising markets and their home prices and all this sort of stuff. But the average person can't even refinance their house, you know, now that this has happened. So yeah, I mean, the middle class, there used to be 20% of our economy maybe, or 30% struggling living paycheck to paycheck. Now the middle class is living paycheck to paycheck. And yes, that hasn't happened since the middle class really emerged after World War II. Okay. That didn't happen in the 1970s when you really get down to it, even that recession.
Okay, so let's investigate then just why this is happening. And I think, you know, my pet thesis here is that there simply aren't substantial jobs being created. And why is that? Because I think our officials and legislators have dropped the ball with regard to the significance of the self-employed and the entrepreneur. Our largest employer right now, Kelly Services and Walmart. This, I think, is indicative of a society that has forgotten what made it great in the first place. So instead of taxing the very few people who are still self-employed, it's the lowest level in national history, into oblivion, you know, perhaps the government needs to be considering tax breaks and incentives to get that entrepreneurial spirit back into gear. I'd like your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to find way to create new businesses and better jobs. And it really is more the entrepreneurs than the local dry cleaners, because they're kind of be around one way or the other. But it is true. I mean, we lost a lot of jobs. And we don't look at the unemployment rate. We look at the total workforce and how many jobs we actually lost and how many we're gaining them back and how many much we should have had if we had grown normally. And there's still a big gap. But the big thing is your pointing out is that we lost good jobs and they've gotten replaced by part-time jobs or lower-paying jobs. That's not good. And then again, that creates the people who are getting hired back are living paycheck to paycheck and struggling because maybe they. I mean, I was just talking to a guy. You know, he said I used to make $25 an hour. Now I make $17 on average. I mean, that's that median household going down, and that's not even adjusted. That's not even adjusted for inflation. I mean, he's down even in nominal dollars substantially. So that's a real problem.
The typical household now is earning substantially less than $30,000 a year, with most homes now either at or near the poverty level. In addition, one out of every four American workers has a job that pays just $10 an hour or less. That's 25% of the employed. We're at one of the lowest levels of total employment in national history. And then also add to the fact that we're near one of the lowest levels of full-time employment, which is another factor we really haven't even touched on here, ties in with the low quality salaries, incomes, and benefits for workers. But, you know, I'd like to shift gears away from this for a moment, and I'd like your thoughts on now that the rate hike is out of the bag and we've passed that, we realize rates had to move up a bit. We've seen that adjustment, and we've certainly seen a very big price reaction in gold and silver. Do you see better times ahead?
I do for a while. Gold broke some really important. I mean, it was trading sideways between 1,525 and 1,800 for almost 2 years, and then broke out of that channel, out of a pattern of a sharp increase before that. That I tell you, 9 out of 10 times should have gone to new highs, and it didn't. So I think what happened to gold was that Indians, who are the biggest buyers in the world up until recently, their rupee started falling for all types of reasons, and the price of gold for them went up, and then they cut back their buying. And then the second thing that happened in early 2013, after QE3 extended, and then the Japanese super aggressive, unprecedented QE announcement, gold went down, and the reason was inflation was falling from 2% to 1%. You're right, they don't measure it right, but that's what the street sees and everybody. And I think gold just finally got an argument I've been making a long time that we're not going to see in substantial inflation or hyperinflation out of all this money printing, because it's just going into financial bubbles. It's going into speculation. It's not going into the economy. It's not creating jobs. It's not creating businesses, you know, and all that sort of stuff. It's not being lent and spent. Money velocity is still dropping like a rock. So gold took this big drop. Probably for several months, gold's going to rally. My target would be about 1500 to 1525 on gold. And if it gets up there, if gold can get back above 1,525 and stay there for a while, then it's got a shot at making a new high. But we are due for a substantial bounce for a good while. And that's just hedge funds selling on leverage. When something like that goes down, it's way beyond the fundamentals, just like oil collapsing and, you know, $147 to $32 in 4 months in 2008. That is leveraged hedge funds and traders dumping for margin calls. That's not fundamental speaking so much.
Also, we're seeing some interesting developments in the futures contracts. We see the backward dating in the 2014 contract on silver and gold. And I can't really think of a time where we saw backwardation in both silver and gold concurrently. We saw it in silver for almost two consecutive years, but never did we see it also in gold and silver. Plus, the COT report indicates that the institutions are covering their shorts almost back to neutral, their short positions, and the specs, of course, are no longer heavily long, and this tends to lead to tradable bottoms. So why don't you tell folks more about your latest, as well as all the services that you provide at your website?
Yeah, our latest book is The Great Crash Ahead. Came out 2 years ago. I've got a new book coming out in January called The Demographic Cliff. But most important, I have a number of newsletters, but we now have a free daily newsletter called Survive and Prosper, and you can get that for free. Sign up just by going to www.harrydent.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, we're so glad you're back with us here at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, Jim Rogers, halfway around the globe at his home office in Singapore. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jim Rogers from his office in Singapore. Good morning, Jim Rogers.
I am delighted to be here. Lots has been going on.
Let's start off today with the equities market. You know, the Dow is near a record all-time high. Earnings continue to be solid. The IPO market is red hot lately. However, insider selling is high. Where do you stand on equities?
You point out, the U.S. market is making all-time highs. I don't particularly like buying anything when it's making all-time highs, although with the rate of money printing in the U.S., it could conceivably go higher or even turn into a bubble. There are signs that it might. Mr. Bernanke and his cohorts have said they will continue to print staggering amounts of money. And while it's artificial, artificial doesn't matter because lots of money flooding into the world markets has got to go somewhere. And one of the places it's going is U.S. stocks. I'm not buying at the moment, but I'm watching closely. I doubt if I get the timing right. Somewhere along the line, this is going to end very badly for all of us. Because it's not just the U.S. central bank that's doing it. It's for the first time in recorded history, we have all the major central banks printing money at the same time. Japan, Europe, U.K. It's always ended badly when a nation does this in the past. This is the first time we've had everybody doing it, so I, for one, am very worried about how it's going to end.
Recently, Dr. Ben Bernanke backpedaled, though, regarding his QE tapering thesis. You say that central banks, they eventually have to stop printing, but can the Fed and their comrades really afford to lose control of their sovereign treasury markets, and won't they just use QE methods to hold rates in check until unemployment gets back to traditional levels?
That's their plan, yes. And so far, so good. Obviously, they would say to you that they've done a brilliant job. I, of course, would say that they're doing a disastrous job, but they would say, no, not that. But what will happen in the end, one of two things has to happen, because this cannot go on forever. They either decide on their own that this has to stop, and they stop or they slow down, or you said they cannot lose control. Well, they don't want to lose control. But whether they like it or not, or whether we like it or not, at some point, the market will say, hey, this is no good. We don't want to play this game anymore, and we won't take your garbage paper. If and when that happens, of course, we all have terrible, terrible problems in the world, because then the central banks lose control, things go escape there, what they would like to happen, and that's going to be pure chaos, not just in the financial market, but in the currency market and all markets and in the world. So it's got to end. It can't go on forever because, if nothing else, the world will run out of trees eventually. So it's going to end whether they try to control it or the market forces them to end it. And either way, it's not going to be fun for the rest of us.
You know, I think that's an interesting segue into another point you've made recently. You went on record that the first two U.S. central banks will close their doors, and eventually the Fed will close its doors. Do you care to predict roughly when, how it will affect the domestic and global economies, as well as what type of system might take its place?
Well, yes, we've had three central banks in U.S. history. The first two disappeared for whatever reason. And in my view, this one will disappear too, because Dr. Bernanke and Dr. Greenspan just have no clue about how the world works. And they have run up huge amounts of debt onto the central bank balance sheet. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, the U.S. central bank had $800 billion on its balance sheet, and it was mainly government bonds. Now, more than quadrupled the assets on its balance sheet. Some of those assets are garbage. You know, they bought up a lot of garbage, in their view, doing the right thing. They might be doing the wrong thing, but it doesn't matter. The facts are they now have four times the balance sheet that they had 5 or 6 years ago, and this has badly because, I mean, that's not the way central banking is supposed to work, not traditionally and historically. It would have been inconceivable to any central banker in the world just a few years ago. But Dr. Bernanke claims he knows what he's doing. I claim he doesn't. The world without central banks has periodically had problems for a variety of reasons. But in my view, this central bank will fail one way or the other, whether Congress will say we've got to get rid of it because the problems will be so bad, or the public will demand getting rid of it because there will be so much inflation, so much debt, so much everything, which will be out of control, and so this central bank will fail. Now, as I said, a world without central banks has problems, but a world with these central banks, who printed staggering amounts of money worldwide and run up huge debt worldwide, will be better off without them, even though we might have other problems without them.
In an interview with Max Keiser this month, you noted that gold is making a significant bottom as leveraged players are forced to liquidate their big positions. And once this finally takes hold, although it could take months or even a couple of years, the bull market will eventually resume, resulting with new high prices. Is that a pretty fair assessment?
Well, that's a fair assessment in my view of the world, yes. I'm not sure we've seen the final bottom yet, although I hasten to tell you I'm terrible at market timing. In my view, we're making a complicated bottom. The problem, the situation with gold is, gold went up 12 years in a row, which is extremely unusual. I know of no market in history that's done that. So the anomaly with gold has been how strong it was for so long. So I would suspect that there will be an anomaly in its making its bottom. It will not just have a correction and then resume its market, as most things do, in my view, and I have no idea how it's going to work. I suspect that the anomaly in its correction will be strange, complicated, if nothing else. Eventually, we will make a new low, whether it's this year or next year or the year after, and then, of course, the bull market will resume, and we're off to the races, and wonderful new highs will be made, but it may be a few years from now.
You know, silver or poor man's gold could shine brightly as this bull market resumes. China and Japan have big plans for photovoltaic systems. The typical solar panel includes up to 1 ounce of silver, which is not easily reclaimed. One media source claims that Asian solar panel demand alone could be enough to absorb much of the new silver production in coming years. Do you have any thoughts on silver?
Same things you do, and also perhaps great medical advances of using silver. Emperors in Korea and other places, for instance, use silver as a protection against the poison and against the cures. And so we may find that silver has lots of uses for health, for other things we haven't thought of. Yes, I own silver. I'm not selling silver. It's rare that silver has a major divergence from gold. If gold goes down 50%, it's unlikely that silver will go up 50%, just to give an example. Yes, there's no question that silver may have a wonderful, wonderful future. I haven't sold any silver. I own silver. They're very, it's certainly down more than gold. If you look at a historic basis, only on a historic basis, I'm certainly not selling my silver, nor am I selling my gold. And if it corrects, and it has a wonderful correction, then I hope I'm smart enough to buy more silver and more gold.
No, anecdotally, that's a very interesting point. For the emperors of Korea actually did use 100% silver chopsticks in order to test for arsenic in their food, because arsenic poisoning due to sibling rivalry over the monarchy was so prevalent. Your investing approach is clearly very contrarian. You suggest that investors should search out sectors with the most bearish players to find value.
Well, I have no idea. My search for value leads to things like agriculture, things like Russia, things like airlines. I think there are things out there where one might find new and interesting investments, perhaps some currencies. That's where I'm looking. One should also know how to sell short, given the, in my view, the turmoil which is coming to all of us in the next few years, whether it's in currencies or bonds or anything, shares. One certainly needs to know how to sell short. And even if one just puts some money in cash, I mean, that could be a disaster if the people who put their cash in Iceland found out, or some other countries, you know. Cash can ruin you if you have the wrong cash, even though you think that you're very safe and secure and conservative. So just be very careful. Conventional investing is not going to work in the next few years.
You always seem to be way ahead of the trends in all these interviews over the last 8 years on GoldSeek.com. So I'd like to ask you, what's on your radar screen that you think investors should start paying attention to in the coming months and years ahead?
Well, currency turmoil, interest rate turmoil, financial markets turmoil, including bankruptcies, the various and sundry things which are going to ruin us all, ruin a lot of people coming in the future. Just, it's not going to be like it's been in the past 10, 20, 30 years. It's going to be very different. I hope that I'm smart enough to figure it all out.
Jim Rogers, we want to thank you so much for taking time for us today and wish you continued success.
Well, thank you. I hope we all have continued success, but it's going to be difficult. We all got to be careful. Let's do it again sometime.
Chris, this is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. My 85-year-old banker friend, whom I speak about occasionally, who, by the way, has more energy than most of us put together, is engaged in a friendly sparring match with one of his best friends. It's not about politics, left versus right. It's not about sports, my team versus your team. And it's not about religion, my faith versus your faith. No, it's about something much more specific, something most listeners to this broadcast have likely had to defend their point of view about more times than they care to remember. And that is their choice and understanding about why investing in physical gold and silver is superior to traditional forms of investing like the stock market. Yes, I concede the fact the stock market is up at all-time highs, and those who have invested with certain stock market gurus have had a good run the past few years. But those same individuals conveniently forget they lost badly in the stock market in 2008 and 2009. The danger, in my opinion, is stock market advocates keep thinking the bubble is going to keep inflating. So much so, they are quickly forgetting how fast and how far the stock market fell in 2008. For many that are high on their profits of the past year or two, they now think the dollar is unquestionably strong. and their stock market guru is even stronger. So much so, they are encouraging their friends to sell their gold at the bottom of a gold and silver correction and buy into a stock market that is at or near its top. Locking in losses at the bottom of a correction in one sector, only to reinvest that money into an overvalued sector, suggests that in all likelihood, you'll be locking in losses a second time when that overvalued sector eventually corrects itself. And it will correct. Well-meaning friends and family who want to claim some kind of moral victory over those who are staunch gold and silver investors and get them to change their ways and invest with their guru are, in my opinion, missing a fundamental understanding of one important principle: counterparty risk. The stock market, the bond market, the dollar, and all paper assets have embedded in their very structure counterparty risk. In other words, all of these instruments are dependent upon someone else's promise to pay. Physical gold and silver have no counterparty risk. They are an end in themselves. Therefore, in today's high-risk environment, where counterparty risk defaults are a daily occurrence, physical gold and silver are superior to any paper asset, even in light of the recent correction. $1,300 gold is still five times what my banker friend paid for his physical gold. $20 silver is still five times what he paid for his physical silver. How long would it take you to make five times on your money in the stock market? Never mind that. How long would it take you to make five times your money if you kept it invested at your bank? The latter would be a mathematical impossibility at the interest rates we've been subjected to the last 5 years. The debate isn't about the stock market versus gold and silver. The debate isn't about my guru versus your guru. The real debate is about the principle of counterparty risk and what it means to your future security. Just ask the people of Detroit, and in the not-too-distant future, a major city in your state, about the importance of counterparty risk. Detroit's recent bankruptcy filing should serve as a warning to those individuals who are expecting help from their state, local, or federal governments. An article on MarketWatch.com this week commented that Detroit's bankruptcy filing is a rude awakening for those expecting a pension or other benefits when they retire, a reminder that it's dangerous to entrust your financial future to others. The idea that it's dangerous to entrust your financial future to others is just beginning to poke its way into mainstream consciousness, but it still has a long way to go. The idea that you should be responsible for your own financial future and not rely on the state or a guru is foreign to most, and therein lies the risk. My entire lifetime, we've been taught to rely on professionals instead of ourselves. There are risks in both approaches. However, it's only physical gold and silver that is absent counterparty risk. And it's the absence of that particular kind of risk that leads me to conclude my banker friend is correct in holding on to his physical gold and silver even in the midst of a painful correction. As more cities declare bankruptcy, and more markets turn out to be illusions of their former selves, more and more people will come to realize that they must rely on their own abilities and savings, because no one is coming to the rescue. In the early 1990s, I attended a presentation by Dr. Nathaniel Brandon, where he explained to the audience that a significant inflection point for personal growth and responsibility is when a person realizes that no one is coming to the rescue. He said at one presentation he had given, someone raised their hand and said, "But Nathaniel, you came." And he replied, "Yes, and I came to tell you that no one is coming." As the so-called Great Recession is acknowledged for what it truly is and has been, the Great Depression number 2, a common theme that will emerge is that no one is coming to the rescue. The collective mindset is slow to change. It still believes the dollar is strong. The stock market is invincible. And the mainstream media tells the truth. One day that paradigm will suddenly change, and we'll start to hear from official sources that we should have known all along, that it was self-evident, and that we are now responsible. For most, it will be a shocking revelation, and in all likelihood, too little, too late. Your ability to survive that day of reckoning rests in large part on your present understanding of the future implications of counterparty risk. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.